had to come up with ways to make people start touching computer screens. And one thing that we tried out is we would put this outline of a hand on the screen, like the one that you see over here, to see if that would help them touch the screen. And I remember one user study where a person came in, sat down next to the service table, and the researcher would ask her questions, and she was sitting there with her hands down. And after about a minute or two, she asked, "Can I please touch the screen now?" Because she wanted to put her hand in that shape. So what we found out, that shape that worked really well to get people to touch the screen. The reason I'm telling this story is because today, that's completely unnecessary. Everybody is used to touching screens. I touch any computer screen that I see, and sometimes it's not a touch screen, and I get kind of pissed off that it doesn't work. But we're so used to having touch screens, it's strange to realize that only 4 or 5 years ago, that was not a common thing at all. So, talking a little bit more about Surface, what I want to talk about today is about touch, and if there's one thing that I want you to walk away with, it is that touch is a language. And what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about what I mean with that. So what is a touch language, or what is an input language? So I'll explain a little bit how that works and what the components are. And then I'll explain what the Windows 8 touch language is, what the components of that language are. But I'm going to start by talking a little bit more about Surface. Because what was interesting about being at Surface is that there's not a lot of legacy. It's a relatively new product, so we had a chance to do a lot of experimentation. Windows is a product that has a lot of users, so it's harder to make big changes there. And at Surface, I was asked to create a new touch language from the ground up. So figure out what is the best way of making a computer that works for touch. What would you do? And we had a lot of opportunity to experiment, to try out different things. Some things were successful. A whole bunch of things failed as well. And what I want to do is I want to show you one user study of something that we tried out that we thought was a really good idea, but it actually didn't work out so well. So what you see here is a Surface table in the forefront, and then two participants sitting next to the table. We always did our user studies with two participants because Surface is a computer that's made for using together. And then on the right-hand side, you just see the hands of the researcher, and the researcher is holding up a piece of paper, and on that paper, they can see the state that they have to bring the system to. So basically what they have to do, there's this window on the screen, they have to move it and make it bigger and then scroll within that content. Now, the idea that we had here of using touch to move windows and scroll within the windows is something that was related to pressure. The idea was that if you would put one finger down, you would just scroll the content within the window, and if you would put two fingers down, you would move the whole window. And that was related to what we call pressure. Like if you press a little bit on something, like if you have a stack of paper, you press a little bit, you'll just move the top piece of paper. If you press harder, you'll move the whole stack. Seems like a pretty simple concept. But we didn't explain this to these people beforehand. We just wanted to see if they could figure it out themselves, if they could understand how this works. So I'm going to show you a little piece of their kind of experimentation of them trying out to figure out how it works. And watch carefully what they think the right way of doing it is.
Got it. Okay, so maybe if you put your hands around the pane, I'll hold this, and then you put your hands inside. Put the soda down, please. That's all right. See how you were moving it inside the pane? Wait, this means I can freeze the pane. I don't know how I did it. But now you reach inside. No, with two hands inside. There you go. There you go.
So we're very grateful to these people, like trying to figure out how it works and going at it. I think in real life they would have walked away before figuring it out. But the interesting thing is that they really truly believe that you have to hold the pane, one person has to hold the pane with two hands while the other person scrolls. So they think that's the way of doing it. So obviously this direction didn't work very well. And we came up with kind of lots of other things. But the interesting thing is that I learned a lot about what works for touch and what doesn't work for touch by trial and error. And I was able to apply that knowledge in Windows. One of the main things that I learned is that what I call people have a mouse brain. And what I mean with that is that when they are touching the screen, often they're referring back to what they know about computers. And what they know about computers is the mouse. And one of the ways you can tell that is when they touch the screen and they tap on the screen, they call it clicking. Whereas there's nothing that's clicking, but that's referring back to clicking the mouse buttons on the mouse. So a lot of it is using touch is actually they're thinking about using the mouse. But if we would then build on that and kind of use those metaphors and use those ways of interacting, we're actually limiting ourselves because touch as a whole has lots of possibilities that you can use that you cannot do with mouse. And I'll dive deeper into that. But to be able to explain that a little bit better, I want to take a step back in history and explain a little bit how new input languages develop. And the way I think that happens is in three stages. The first stage is where a new technology gets developed. So, for instance, the mouse or touch. And in that first stage, we're just playing around with the technology, but we're not actually using it for something yet. In the second stage, what we do is we take that technology and we apply it to something that we already know. So we take some other language and we use that for this new technology. And it's only in the third stage where we develop a language for that new technology itself. Now, I'm going to give you two examples and then I'll talk about touch. And the first one is about film. So when the film camera was first invented, it was used for kind of technical experimentation. For instance, these are pictures made by Muybridge, who was trying to figure out what the different gaits are that horses use. And he could figure that out using the film camera. It's much harder to see that with the naked eye. So that's stage one. It's just experimenting with what can you do with a film camera. Then in stage two, what they did is they would take a film camera and put it in the audience of a theater and film the stage. So literally film a place, film the play from a single vantage point. Not move the camera, not turn the camera or anything, and then take that movie, bring it to another theater, and display it in exactly the same way. So what happened is this new technology, this film camera, was used with the old language of theater. So it was literally taking a play and projecting it in another theater. And it was only until the 50s when movies like Citizen Kane came out when we started developing our own language for film and for movies. And that included panning, moving the camera around, zooming in, moving the camera to different places, not leaving it in a single point, but taking it outside of the studio, different kinds of cuts. And these are all things that today we're completely used to. It's so normal to think about panning and zooming and things like that. But 100, 150 years ago, these terms, they didn't exist. These ideas didn't exist. This language didn't exist. So this was a language that was specifically developed for film, for movie making. Now, how does that apply to input methods for computers? Let's have a look at mouse. The mouse was invented in 1968, and I bet you've seen this one before, developed by Engelbart at Stanford. This is a picture of the first mouse. And initially that was just used as we were just experimenting with the technology. So it was a way of pointing out an XY coordinate on the computer screen, but we didn't really know what to do with it yet. And originally, when the mouse was first launched, this is a picture, but it was first launched with the TR-440 computer by AEG Telefunken. It was actually launched with the command line interface. So there were no windows, there were no things you could drag around, there was just text on the screen and then a mouse. It seems kind of weird, like why would you do that? And it took 5 years after the mouse was invented until the first graphical user interface was created. And this one is by Xerox PARC for the Alto computer. And this is where concepts like windows, icons, menus, and pointers were created. And that's the language that goes with the mouse, that we now think is completely normal that you have this graphical user interface to go with the mouse. But originally, it wasn't there. There was a mouse, but there was no graphical user interface. So this is what I call an input language. This language has to be developed for the technology. Well, what are the different aspects of an input language? First of all, there's the input properties. And there's two parts of that. There's the technology part of it, and there's the human part of it. The technology part is what can you do with that technology, right? So like a mouse, you can move it on a horizontal plane, you can specify an XY coordinate, you have one or two buttons or more buttons. That's all what the technology specifies. Then there's the human property. What can you do with your body, or if you have different input methods, what can you do with speech, for instance? And those two things, the human properties and the technical properties, they determine the interactions that are possible. For instance, with a mouse, you can move it left, right, up, down. There's a left mouse button, there's a right mouse button, and you can click those. So there's different interactions that are possible. Then the system provides feedback to those interactions. If you move your mouse cursor over an item, the item highlights, for instance. If you click on it, it gets depressed. And then there's system feed forward. The feed forward shows you what you can do. So for instance, if you see a computer with a mouse, you know, oh, that's one of those graphical user interfaces that I know. And if you see a cursor on the screen, you know, that's the thing that I can move. If you see a button, you think, oh, that's something that I can click on. So these are the elements that make up an input language. And what I want to do now is talk a little bit about touch. So how is that language developing for touch? Well, touch has been around for a long time as well. This is a picture of the Plato 4 computer from 1973 that actually has a touchscreen. It's a 16 by 16 resolution touchscreen. But touch is not something that was invented in the last 5 or 10 years. It's been around for about 50 years at least. But what I think is that we are still somewhere between stage 2 and stage 3. We haven't really developed that language for touch yet. What we're doing often is emulating mouse language. So for instance, if you tap on a button, that button came from the graphical user interface. We don't have specific things that work well for touch. Some things are there already, like if you zoom on a map or on a photo, that's not something you can do with a mouse. That's something you need two fingers for. So we're somewhere in between there, but there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. And what I want to do now is talk a little bit about some of that work that we've done in Windows and then talk about the touch language. So I'll start explaining a little bit about those human properties for touch. And one of those things is our fat finger. If you use mouse, you get this very precise pointer, this very precise arrow on the screen that points to one single pixel on the screen. And our computer systems are designed to work with that single XY coordinate. But if you put your finger on the screen, it doesn't point to a single pixel. It actually covers a whole bunch of pixels. So it becomes kind of unclear what you're pointing at, which is what we call the fat finger, because your finger is also covering a whole bunch of pixels. So that's what you see on the screen there is what the computer sees is only that single XY coordinate that's in the middle of the crosshair. But actually, what's touching the screen is that whole dark area of your finger, and what's covering the screen is even more than that. And because of that, what happens is, here's an example, like when I'm touching the screen with my finger, I am touching the play button. You can see the play button on the right-hand side. I'm even touching three buttons, but I can think that my finger is right there on the play button. But actually what the computer system sees, in this case, is that my finger is touching to the top left of the play button, outside of the play button. So even though my finger is physically completely covering that play button, the computer still thinks I'm not touching it. And that is because we're translating the finger touching the screen into the single XY coordinate, which is actually something that we got from mouse. So in Windows 8, we looked at how can we make the computer system smarter and really understand touch, understand what a finger is, how a finger touches the screen, and that a finger doesn't represent, or that a finger is not as big as a single XY coordinate, as a single pixel. So here's a movie that I'll show you to show you how that works. What's going to happen is on the top left-hand side, you will see a hand touching the edges of that window and the corner of the window. Then on the bottom right-hand side, you will see how that's interpreted by Windows 8, by the computer system. There's a larger circle which represents the portion of the finger that's touching the screen. It will be a circle or an ellipse, depending on how the finger touches the screen. Then in the middle, you will see the XY coordinate, which what the computer system would normally think it is. But you will also see that it actually translates that XY coordinate to a different point. So it says, oh, if the edge of the window is within that circle, within the area of the finger that's touching the screen, I'm going to move that XY coordinate. So here I'm trying to touch the edge of the window, and you can see on the bottom right-hand side that the system actually moved the XY coordinate to within the area where my finger is touching. So in this case now, when I'm physically touching that edge of the window, I will be able to move it, where in a previous computer system, like in Windows 7, it would have been seen as missing the window. And the same works for trying to touch icons or trying to touch text. So this is something that you get for free in Windows 8. You don't have to do anything for it. What we did is we built the input stack in such a way that it understands better what touch is. Now, I'll talk about some other things that we did to think about what touch means for Windows. And one of the things to get a better understanding is we did lots of field studies with our users, with people who are using Windows in their homes, in their offices. And here you see some pictures of those field studies. So what we did is we gave people tablets, and then we would follow them. We would stay with them for the first few hours to see how they would use it. We would come back after a day and look at what they were doing, ask questions, come back after a week, come back after a month. And one of the things that we wanted to learn is how are these people holding their tablets? So we call that posture. What is the posture that they're using? And what we found is that there's two postures that are really important for us. One posture is where people are holding the tablet with their non-dominant hand. So if you're right-handed, that would be your left hand. And they're actually supporting it on their legs, on their lap, or sometimes on the table, as you see there. And now they have their dominant hand free for interacting with the device. So I'm holding the tablet like this, and now I have my finger free to interact, but I actually have my whole hand free to interact. So I can zoom, or I could use each of my five fingers or all five at the same time. That's the first posture that we see most commonly. The second one that we often see is where people hold the tablet with two hands, and then they have their two thumbs free for interacting with the device. And in this way, you can actually stand up, and you don't have to necessarily rest the tablet on something else. Because we don't very often see that people just hold the tablet with one hand and interact with it, because it's not a very stable position. So in this way, you can still interact, but you can only interact with your thumbs, with both of your thumbs. So those are the two most important postures. And especially about the second one, we wanted to learn a little bit more. Like, what does it mean if you're interacting with your thumbs? So what we did is we gave people a piece of paper the size of a tablet, and then we asked them to dip their thumbs in finger paint and then paint on that piece of paper which areas were easy to reach and which areas were hard to reach. And then the areas they can't reach at all, obviously they can't paint there. So in that way we got different pictures of these spots of areas that were easy to reach for people. And I'll show you some examples. And what we did with those pictures is we combined them all into one statistically representative image of the areas that people could reach with their thumb. Now, there's actually different images of this, because there's what we call a palm grip, where people hold the tablet with the corner in the palm of their hand, and there's also an edge grip, where they hold it with the edge. So what you're seeing here is a picture of the palm grip. And what you can see is the green area is easy to reach, and then the further out you go, the harder it is to reach, and those other areas are, it's kind of impossible to reach with your thumbs. What's interesting is you can't reach far, obviously, but you also can't reach that close by, because your thumb can't bend any further than a certain number of degrees. Now, what we did with this map is we used that to develop the user interface. So, for instance, we created the thumb keyboard. There's a a normal on-screen keyboard that you can use, but there's also a version that's the thumb keyboard, which has the keys on the left and the right-hand side, so you can actually type with your thumbs. And other things we did is we used this to look at the applications that we were developing to make sure you could still navigate the whole application easily with just your two thumbs. So you would be able to scroll lists, for instance, and navigate to the most important places. So I'll talk about some other things that we looked at. One is we learned more about these human properties related to touch. And some of the things, I'll talk about some of the things that we learned. One is that our body is made for contracting our muscles. So what we're good at is grabbing things like this. What we're less good at is extending your muscles. Those muscles are always weaker. So the movement of contracting your finger is easier than the movement of extending your finger, or contracting your hand is easier than extending your hand. Another one is that your fingers are much more precise than the joints that go further up the chain of your arm. So, for instance, if you have a thumb grip, now your thumb is pretty precise because you're just using your finger digits. But if you're not locking your hand to the slate, but you're using your arm like kind of free-flowing, you're going to be much less precise because now I have to use all these joints to kind of stable my arm. So my targeting is less precise. I can make less precise movements. Another thing that our joints are made for circular movements, right? They don't make straight movements. They always make circular movements. But computer systems are often designed with straight lines, right? We scroll in straight lines. We do other things in sliders are in straight lines, for instance. So what we had to do, or what that means, is that we will actually be sloppy in making those straight lines. Because if I have to make a straight line with my finger like this, I'm actually using multiple joints at the same time. So we had to account for that sloppiness of not being able to make a very straight line. So those are some of the things that we learned. And I'll show you later on what we did in the designs to account for that. There's another aspect that I want to talk about touch, what's important for touch, and that's about direct manipulation. So roughly, you could say there's two kinds of gestures. One kind is what we call symbolic gestures, where you perform a gesture, and once you're done with that gesture, it is interpreted by the computer system, and the computer will perform a command. The other one is called direct manipulation, or is called manipulation gestures. And what happens with manipulation gestures is when you touch the screen, you get continuous and incremental feedback about what's happening. So you immediately see what is happening. And I'll show you the difference. These are two examples of navigating from photo to photo, from picture to picture. The first one is using symbolic gestures. So you have to move your finger at a certain speed and a certain distance to go to the next image. And if you do that wrong, if you don't move at the right speed or the right distance, nothing happens. If you do it right, you go to the next picture, but it happens after the gesture has happened. So there's no direct feedback of your gesture. I'll show it again. Now here's the direct manipulation version of the same thing. So it's the same gesture, the same movement. I'm still moving from left to right, but now I'm getting continuous and incremental feedback about what I'm doing, which makes it much easier to understand what I'm doing. It's like, oh, I'm moving my finger to the right, the photo is going to move, I'm going to go to the next picture. If you like it, you continue your gesture. If you don't like it, you just move your finger back to where it came from. So as much as possible, what we recommend is to use these direct manipulations rather than using symbolic gestures. And I'll give some examples of that later on as well. Another thing that we've been working on for the Windows 8 touch language is thinking about timed gestures. So we have a gesture space. We have a number of gestures that we can use to communicate with the system. But there's only so many gestures, right? You can tap. Maybe you can double tap. You can move up, down, left, right. Maybe you can move at diagonal angles. Then you could have one finger or multiple fingers. And by that time you're kind of done. There's no other gestures that you can perform. So there's only so many things you can do. So in many computer systems, you will see that the aspect of time is used. If you tap on something, then something happens. But if you hold your finger down, something else will happen. So the longer I hold my hand down, something else will happen. And here's an example of Windows 7. If you hold your finger down longer on the screen, you will get a context menu. What we're recommending is don't use time gestures for important tasks. We are using it for something else, which I'll explain in a minute. There's two reasons why I think you should not use time gestures for these important tasks. One is, if you have a novice user, so somebody who doesn't know the computer system very well, they will accidentally activate this this feature. So if they hold their finger down on the screen inadvertently, they might accidentally invoke this context menu. And it's actually a modal experience. So once this context menu is there, you can't scroll anymore. You can't do something else anymore. You first have to dismiss the context menu and then go back to there. That can be very confusing. Another example is on the iPhone, if you have to, or the iPad, if you want to rearrange your icons, you have to hold down. And I've seen many people do this accidentally. So then you're in this mode where you're in a rearrange mode and you don't know how to get out of it. So for novice users, it causes accidental activation. For experienced users, it actually slows them down. Because you have to have a certain time that you have to wait until this action happens. If it's too fast, then you'll have too much accidental activation. So often it's a second or maybe 800 milliseconds. So that means that if I want to use the context menu, I have to wait a second every time I use the context menu. And the whole idea about the context menu is that it's fast, that I can quickly can get to it. So that kind of defeats the purpose. So it doesn't work well for novice users, it doesn't work well for experienced users. But you can use it for tasks that are not critical or that you don't have to perform, that you have to perform only once. And I'll show that in a minute. Now what I'll do next is talk about the Windows 8 touch language, like what makes up the Windows 8 touch language. I'll highlight some of those features, and then I'll talk a little bit about kind of our thinking of that. But before I do that, I want to show you a little clip from one of our user studies. So here's a woman, she's actually sitting in the lab, but we made the lab in such a way that it more mimics some situation that you would find at home. So there's a sofa there, and we tell the participants of the study that they can sit however they want to. So some are kind of lounging, laying down on the sofa. She is actually sitting cross-legged, and she put a pillow on her lap. We have pillows and different kinds of things that they can use. And then she put the tablet on top of that because that's the easiest way for her to use it. Now, this person was not a touch user at all. She hadn't used touch screens. Well, she had used them like a few times, but she did not have any phones with touch screens or computers with touch screens, and she really liked her computer with the mouse, and she wasn't really into touchscreens yet. But when she was using this, she actually became more convinced about that it could be a good thing. What we were testing here is we were testing the touch language that we developed, but across the whole system. So the touch language is only useful if it is implemented consistently across the system. So what we tried is implemented in the start menu, but also in different applications, and then have the participants in the studies figure out themselves how the touch language works, and then have them talk to us about it. And I'd like you to listen to what she has to say about that.
I can set a very small learning curve once you know the touch. I like the fact that they're the same in every, would it be application? That once you know how to operate email, this operates the same. Selecting the pictures operated the same, etc. I like the continuity. How's that?
So what she's talking about is there are a number of new gestures that are not conventions that people don't know. So there is a learning curve. You have to learn some new gestures. But she was able to learn them pretty quickly, is what she says. And then what she liked about it is that once she learned it, she could use it throughout the system. So once she knew this touch language, she could use it throughout the system. And this is something that we heard consistently from from the participants of our user studies. So what were the goals of our touch language? Well, first of all, we wanted it to be simple and consistent because we wanted it to be easy to learn. And once you learned it, you have to be able to apply it across the system. And to make it simple, we wanted to have a limited gesture set. So we were trying not to have all kinds of exotic and wild gestures, but just keep that very limited. We wanted to focus very much on direct manipulation and use that whenever we can. We also wanted to focus on sliding interactions. So a lot of the touch interfaces that you see today are based on mostly on tapping. There's a lot of tapping on buttons and tapping to go to different screens, and then a little bit of sliding for scrolling. But actually, sliding your finger across the screen is really easy to do. Our bodies are kind of made for those kinds of gestures in addition to tapping. So we wanted to make use of those interactions, and I'll show you what I mean with that. Then we wanted interactions to be reversible. So if you think about what I just said about direct manipulation, if you move your finger to the right on the photo and you see the photo moving and the new one coming in, you can see like, oh, that's what this gesture does. A new photo comes in. And if that's not what you wanted to do, you just move your finger back and you're back to where you came from. So we wanted to have that principle wherever we could, so that it becomes safe to explore. You can put your finger down and start moving it, and if something happens that you like, you continue. If you don't like it, you just reverse that interaction, and you're back to where you came from. So it becomes safe to try out things. We also wanted that to happen between interactions. So if you move your finger to the right and you lift your finger and you're at the new a different picture, then, and you don't like that, you can put your finger down and move it to the left, so reverse the gesture, and you're back to where you came from. That's what we mean with reversible interactions. As much as possible, we wanted to avoid modes. So we didn't want to have a way where if you want to rearrange something, you have to go into a mode and now you can rearrange something. Or if you want to select multiple items, you have to go into a mode and then you can select those items. And the reason is, first of all, you have to get into that mode, which is hard to figure out. But then there's a lot of mode errors. So people don't know if they're in that mode or not in that mode or what's happening. And we wanted to avoid that. We do have modes which we call kinesthetically held modes. So it could be, for instance, a mode when your finger's down on the screen, the system reacts differently than when you lift your finger. And finally, we wanted to limit the use of time gestures, as I talked to you about. So what is that touch language? Well, it's based on 8 gestures. Some of those are familiar to you. And each of those gestures are mapped to functions. So there's press and hold to learn, and I'm going to explain what that means. There's tap still for the primary action, like launching an application, for instance, or looking at making a picture full screen. Slide to pan, as you use, slide to pan or scroll. Then there's swipe to select, and that's a new gesture, which I'll talk about in a minute. There's pinch and stretch to zoom, which by now is a touch convention. Turning your fingers to rotate. And then there's 2 kind of newer ones, which is swiping from the top or the bottom edge of the screen to invoke app commands, and swiping to the left or the right edge from the screen to invoke system commands. Now, these are all the interactions, all the gestures and interactions that we have for Windows 8. So that's the whole gesture part of the language. There's other behaviors that I'll talk about. But. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to highlight some of those gestures and talk a little bit about why we created them like that and how they work. And the first one I want to talk about is swipe to select. So this is one of those cases where we wanted to avoid modes. If you use a mouse, if you single-click on an item, you select it, you highlight it, and if you double-click, you open it. And it works really well. But with touch, the way we've created our systems is that if you tap on something, so not double-tap, but the single-tap on something, you open it. So what we did, we lost our ability to select items. And in many systems, what you'll see is that they'll go into a mode. So you have to go into a selection mode, and now you can select items. And we wanted to avoid that. So what we did is we looked at these sliding gestures that I talked about, and we tried to find ways of using those sliding gestures to select. And the way we did that is we looked at if there's a list or a grid, a scrolling grid, that often scrolls in one direction, and then we use the other direction for selecting. And I'll show what I mean with that. So here's an example of a start menu, the Windows 8 start menu. If I go What I did is I turned the touch visuals on, so that dark circle that you see here in the top, that's my finger touching the screen. So I can move to the left and right to scroll through the list, just as what you're used to. But now, if I, for instance, touch the mail item and I start moving my finger down, I am moving that whole item down, and on the top right-hand side of the mail item, you see a check mark appear. Now, if I continue to go down, you will see a highlight appear around that tile. And at this point, if I lift my finger off the screen, I've selected that item. And I can do the same gesture to unselect it. So I'll show that again. I put my finger down, the check mark appears, I move it a little bit further down, you see the highlight appear, meaning it's selected. And then I can move my finger further down, but at this point nothing happens. I can let go and I select something. And I can do that with multiple items. So I can select, in this way I can select multiple items. What you will also see is that when I do this, in the bottom of the screen, a taskbar appears. So I can now easily select items, and then a taskbar appears with commands, and now I can perform commands on those items. So it's an easy way to say, take these three things, or take this single thing, and then do something with them. For instance, make them smaller. And if I don't like it, I can select it again and make it larger. And this works in different environments. So for instance, this is the all programs view. And again here, I can select items. And it works just the same way. Even though this list looks differently, it works in a different way. But selection works in the same way. And the same for apps. Like if you have an app with a grid with photos or something, or an email, a list of emails, you can select there as well. It's always dragging orthogonally to the scrolling direction. Now there's a few aspects of this, of how this works. One is that if I put my finger down, I will reveal that check mark. And the idea is there, we were looking at ways to teach people how to select. Because originally they have to learn this new gesture. So that's why this check mark is there, so you can see how to select. Then we built in what we called speed bumps. So if I move my finger further down, the item actually moves less, the tile moves less. And we call that a speed bump. So it becomes easy to be sloppy. I can quickly go down with my finger to select, because we have created the system for you to be sloppy. And I can also be a little bit off in my directions. Another thing is, because we don't have any special UI on the tile, like a little check mark or checkbox that you have to tap on, you can actually slide anywhere on that tile to select it. So that makes it really easy to select. So combining the large hit target with the kind of an ability to be sloppy makes it easy to select. Now, some people ask, like, oh, isn't it hard to learn this new gesture? Why did you change this? Why did you come up with this new thing? The way I think about this is, it is better to teach people a new gesture that works really well for the properties of this new input language than to try to map it to something that we already know that doesn't work so well. So you have to put a little bit of effort into learning this, but once you learned it, it's really easy to use. And we spend a lot of effort on teaching people how to do that. And that's what we used our press and hold gesture for, which I'll explain in a minute. But what I wanted to do here is show a little clip of another user study, where there's a person, she has just learned how to select 2 minutes ago. And we actually didn't explain her how to select. We just said, select one of those albums in the list that you see on the right hand side. So she learned that by herself. It took her a minute or 30 seconds to learn it, but then she was able to use it. And what's happening here is the researcher who is just off screen on the right hand side is asking her what she thinks about this gesture, if she likes it or not. And while she's thinking about it, she's actually playing with the screen. So watch carefully what she's doing while she's thinking about her answer.
Now that you've had a little more time to play with this and selecting and rearranging and the content. that menu. Tell me what you liked.
Now that I know how to do the selection, I like that.
Why?
Because it takes a flick of the finger movement. It's very easy to, I can go all over a bunch of them and select them.
So this is her after she learned the gesture a few minutes ago, and she goes really fast selecting all these items just because she's kind of playing around with it. And this is in general what we saw. Some people have a little bit harder time to learn it, some have an easier time to learn it, but everybody learns it within a few minutes. And then once they can use it, they really like that gesture. So I think it's really worth it. So how can you use this? Well, I think it's the best way to provide selection, but selection by itself is not really anything. It's more about commanding. So it's more about enabling people to do things with items that are in your app. And the easiest way to enable that is by using the controls. So there's as you probably know, there's a number of controls that are that come with Windows 8, and specifically in this case the list and the grid controls, so those are collections that can scroll, they have selection built into them. So another gesture I want to talk about is swiping from the edge. And this is, after this talk, my colleague Jan Christian Markiewicz is going to talk about Metro apps, and one of the important things about Metro style design is that it focuses on the content. And to do that, we want to try to have less what we call Chrome, so less other UI that's always, less other user interface elements that are always available. And one of the ways that we kind of got those elements off screen is by having this gesture of swiping from the edge. So the commands. Well, here's actually an example. So for instance, if I want to perform Windows commands, I want to go back to the start menu or I want to search for something, all I do is I swipe from the right-hand side, and those commands are right there. And I can go to the start menu. And then I can, for instance, if I'm in the browser, I can swipe from the bottom or from the top, and I get my browser commands there. So the UI is always very close by, but it's not cluttering your screen if you don't need to have it. And again, this is a gesture that people have to learn. This is something that they don't just learn by themselves. You can't just give them a tablet and they'll figure out that they can swipe from the edge. So what we have to do is we have to explain it to them. But it's actually really easy to explain. All you have to say is like swipe from the edge and that's where all your commands are, and then they will remember it. You say it only once and they'll use it in our studies. People will use it throughout the study. They don't forget about it. So how can you use swipe from the edge? Well, it's enabled, like especially the Windows commands are always there. But what you can do is for apps, you have the bottom and the top swipe available to bring up commands. And you can bring up those commands any way you want to, but the way we recommend to do it is to put them in the app bar, because that's something that people will be used to. Hold to learn is another gesture that I want to talk about, and that's interesting because I've just been telling you that you shouldn't be using time gestures, and here we have hold to learn, which is a time gesture. So why do we still have this gesture? Well, because our philosophy is that we don't only want to provide gestures that you already know, but we want to be able to extend our touch language. We have to have a way to teach you how to use that language. In mouse, there's using a mouse and a cursor, there's a great way of doing it. You can hover with your cursor over something, and then you will see more information. You'll get a tooltip, the item will often highlight. With touch, we don't have that. Either your hand is not on the screen and the computer's not seeing anything, or your finger's on the screen and then you're tapping, and then it's already too late. So you can't use that to explore something. So that's why we're using this hold to learn gesture to learn about things. It's a safe way to explore. You can put your finger down on something, which basically gives you the mouse hover back. But it's not kind of dangerous because you don't have to actually activate something. And it is slower, but that's okay because you're learning. and you only have to learn it once or maybe twice, but after that you don't have to use that gesture anymore. So it's not such a big deal that it's slower. Now I'll show some examples of hold to learn. For instance, if I see a tile here and I don't know what that tile is about, like the photo that's in the middle of the screen, I can put my finger down on there and I'll get a tooltip. So it will say this is the Picasa app in this case. And this one, the tooltip has to be enabled. So that's one way of doing it. But the other way is what you just saw here, is if I don't know, for instance, say I don't know how to select, but I want to select. And in some places you select by press and hold. So maybe I'll try to press and hold if I don't know what to do. And then I'll see that the tile moves slightly down and the check mark appears. I'll do this again. I put my finger down on the tile. It moves a little bit down and the check mark appears. And that's what we call a self-revealing gesture. So I can put my finger down on something and the item itself will give me a little hint of what it is that I can do with it. So I put my finger down, it slides a little bit down, and now I'm like, oh, I can slide it further down, and now I selected an item. And that's a way that we are teaching people how to select. This is not the final animation that you see here. It actually developed further because we had to do a lot of detailed work on making sure that it worked for teaching people how to select something. But we did make it so that it actually works, that people can learn this gesture without us having to tell them or give them a tutorial or something like that. And I'm actually going to talk at the end of the day, I think it's at 3 o'clock, I will talk in much more detail about that whole process that we went through, about how we can figure out how these self-revealing gestures work. So that's about hold to learn. So what it does is it provides this extra layer of information, either as a tooltip or as a self-revealing gesture to learn without you having to commit to something. So it's a safe way to learn. And an easy way of using this is using the tooltip control. Well, zooming is a gesture that you already know. It became a convention. It's interesting to know that 5-10 years ago, nobody knew it. It was not a convention, but now this is a touch convention. But when we zoom, we mostly refer to optical zoom, so making something smaller or bigger literally. And something that we're adding in Windows is what we call semantic zoom. Now, the reason we do this is because we are also when we use direct manipulation for touch, we're also losing something. If you use a mouse to scroll through a collection, for instance, you have a scroll bar, and that scroll bar has a lot of functionality in it. You can use it to quickly go to the beginning or the end of the document by clicking on the thumb and dragging it to the beginning of the end of the scroll bar. You can scroll line by line, you can scroll page by page, you can say, I want to go to 2/3 of the document, and you can drag the thumb to 2/3. If you use direct manipulation, you lose a lot of that functionality. Like if you quickly want to go to the end of a list, you have to do a lot of sliding on the screen. So semantic zoom is a way of giving you back some of that functionality without having to show a lot of UI on the screen. So for instance, I want to quickly go to the end of this start menu. Instead of going like this, scrolling through, what I can do is I can put my two fingers down, zoom out, and I get a smaller view of my start menu. But this is not just a view, this is not just making the tile smaller. First of all, there's only two views. There's the normal view that you just saw, and then there's the zoomed out view. There's nothing in between. Second of all, the tiles are adapting in this view, so they're not the same tiles. Actually, all the details disappeared, all the text disappeared, and they're just colored tiles with large logos so that I can still easily recognize my apps. And I'll show you another example. For instance, in the All Programs view, if I want to zoom out here, I will get a different view, but that view can be adapted to what it's most useful for. So in this case, it's an alphabetized list. So if I zoom out, instead of getting small tiles, I'll get the alphabet. And I can quickly jump to a letter, or I can quickly jump to folders for apps that I created. So in that way, you can use semantic zoom, and that zoomed out view can be anything that you want it to be. It's a different representation of the same data that makes it easy for you to get an overview of that collection and makes it easy to jump to the beginning or the end or to kind of roughly a place within that collection. It is always right there. So it's very easy. I just use my two fingers to zoom out to get there, but it doesn't clutter the screen with any UI. And this is another one of those gestures. Most people know zooming already, but they don't know semantic zoom. But once they discover it, in our studies, our users would always try it everywhere. And I'll show you an example of that. So here's a user who is just discovering this gesture.
Oh my god, that is crazy. Yeah, that's cool. And then, yes, that's very interesting. I like that a lot.
So that's pretty typical from what we heard in our user studies. In this case, it's a fake Netflix app. This is not a real Netflix app, where we zoomed out to the different categories, different movie categories. So semantic zoom provides a touch-enabled way of jumping to content and getting an overview of that content. And there's a control for this. It's called the semantic zoom controller, the semantic controller. And that's the easiest way to enable this in your app. Or if you use a list or a grid control, then it's also enabled. So that's all I wanted to say today about the different touch interactions. But there's other behaviors that are part of the touch language, of the Windows 8 touch language. And I want to talk a little bit about that right now. So first I want to talk about touch feedback. So to me, touch feedback is really, really important. And what it actually does is it is the system communicating back to you. So I am communicating to the system. I'm communicating to the computer by touching it. I'm telling it something. And then it should talk back to me and tell me what it understands or what it's seeing. And this is how we communicate with each other, right? Like when we communicate with each other, there's facial expressions, there's gestures, there's body posture that shows you like, oh, I understand you, I heard you. And we really need that. We that's how we communicate with each other. Computers are often not doing that. And in my view, they're often impolite or rude, I would say. So if you think about a computer that doesn't react to touch, like I'm touching the screen and nothing happens, or it takes a while for something to happen, maybe because the computer is a little bit slow, an app is hanging or something, or maybe because I'm touching something that's not interactive, so there's nothing that reacts, often the computer will not say anything back to you. And as far as I'm concerned, that's as if I'm having a conversation with you like this and you're looking at the back of my head while I'm talking to you. It's just kind of rude, I think. And it doesn't really enable the communication in a good way. Actually, what I need to do right now. So I had a special kind of touch visuals turned on for you to present, but I'm going to turn those off right now. And there's different ways of how we provide feedback. What we're recommending is that whenever somebody touches something on the screen that's interactive, it should react to you. So for instance, I'm touching on the desktop tile, and then it moves down slightly so that I can see that something is happening. But then when I'm touching somewhere else, I should see that I'm touching it. So in the top of the screen, you see those pretty subtle circles. They're actually so subtle that normally you won't really notice them, you won't really notice what's happening, until you start touching something where you expect it to react, but it doesn't do anything. And then you can see, oh, the system did hear me, but there, if I tap on start, for instance, nothing happens, because start is not a button. But I know that the system heard me. If I tap here, something happens. If I tap here, nothing happens, but the system heard me, it's not broken. I think that's a very important aspect of creating a good touch system. I'll tell you a little story about what happens if you don't do that. So some time ago, I was in an airplane, and we had those little TV screens on the back of the seats. And you can play games on those. And this one was touch-enabled. But the person behind me was playing a game. But every time there was an announcement in the airplane, that system would be disabled. So touch wouldn't work anymore. But you wouldn't know it. Like, if you would touch it, there's never any feedback. So whenever the announcer came on and started telling something, this person behind me started banging harder on the seat, and my head would be bobbing up and down because he didn't understand what was happening to the system. And something like this would stop that from happening, because you understand, like, oh, the system is hearing me. Oh, the system is not hearing me. Something must be broken. If you're dragging on the screen, then you will see little trails that are here behind my finger. Yeah, you can see those. You don't see my fingers, but you see the little trails. So those show that you're dragging. So in that way, we're always providing feedback. Either you're touching an item and it highlights, or it shrinks, or if you touch something that's not interactive, then you will see those touch visuals. So the system says, I heard you. So a lot of this you get for free, but what we're recommending is to use the controls for the best feedback experience. And if you have any other interactive elements that you created yourself, make sure it has that visual feedback. So now I want to talk a little bit about target sizes. And the question that is most asked of me when I tell people that I'm working on touch is, how big should the buttons be that I create? How big should my touch targets be? And that's all related to the fingers. But actually, there's not a single number answer that I can give you. It's not like, oh, make them this big and everything will be fine. Because it depends very much on the circumstances. And I'll explain to you what I mean with that. So there is not one size that works or doesn't work. What happens is, the larger your touch target sizes are, the less errors will be made. And we wanted to learn more about this. So what we did is lots and lots of studies with users where we had them touch little squares on the screen to see what the error rates were. So we had squares of 3 millimeters, 5 millimeters, 7 millimeters, like whole grids of them, and then we had them touch those squares and record the errors. And this is what came out of that. So you can see that the larger your target size is, the lower your error rate gets, and there must be some optimization that we can do there. And this is what we're recommending. There's three target sizes: 7 millimeters, 9 millimeters, and 11 millimeters. If you have a 7 millimeter target size, your error rate will be about 4%. So one in every 25 taps will be wrong. Unintended will happen, or nothing will happen. If you have a 9 millimeter target size, it will be 1%, 1 in 100 taps. If it's 11 millimeters, it's 1 in 1,000 taps. So, and we use this for our recommendation. The sizes you see here are actually 2 millimeters smaller because there's padding. So when we say 5 millimeters, that actually refers to the 7 millimeter I talked about before, and I'll explain in a minute why that is. But our recommended touch target size is 7 by 7 millimeters. If you want to have one number, that's the number I'm going to give you. Make your target at least 7 by 7 millimeters with 2 millimeters padding around it. And that will work pretty well. But if you have something where it's a bad thing if users make a mistake, and the way I define it, if it's a lot of work to correct your mistake, I say you should have touch targets that are at least 9 by 9 millimeters plus the 2 millimeters padding. And an example for that is the start menu. If you launch an app and it's the wrong app, you accidentally launch the wrong app, you have to wait for it to launch, which will take you, I don't know, 10 or 20 seconds. Then you'll have to close the app, and then you'll have to find the app that you actually wanted to launch and launch that. So it's a lot of work to correct for that error. You don't want that to happen. Your users, your people who use your app, will get frustrated. On the other hand, sometimes you are creating your UI and you want things to be smaller. You don't want to have those huge buttons, those Fisher-Price buttons there. So then you can optimize for small size. And the recommendation there is to use 5 by 5 millimeters with 2 millimeters padding. And a good example of that is radio buttons. If you tap on the wrong radio button, it's very easy to correct. You just tap again right next to it, and then you tap on the right button. It's actually so easy that what we found in the user studies is that most people don't even realize that they tapped twice, because it's so easy to correct for that. So that's how we come up with our different recommendations. 7x7 for recommended size, 9x9 or larger to optimize for accuracy, and you'll see that the tiles on the start menu are much larger than that, because we really don't want people to make mistakes. And then there's optimizing for small size as well. So what is this padding about? Well, the padding actually doesn't make the error rate any better or any lower. But what it does is it provides the users with more confidence. So if we add those 2 million, so we tried different versions with padding, without padding, less padding, more padding. But if we add that 2 millimeters of padding, then users, people feel like they're better at targeting those targets. They feel more confident about targeting them in the right way. So that's why we're saying, instead of just having, say, the 9x9 millimeters recommended size, make it 7x7 with 2 millimeters of padding. So that's the end of this talk. I just wanted to reiterate a little bit about what it means to have a language. So we looked at the input properties, the human properties, and the technology. I showed you the different interactions that we designed for the Windows 8 Touch language, and I talked about the system feedback and a little bit about system feed forward. But then there's more to that. So what's really important is that this touch language is consistent across the system. So we can design it in the Windows UI part of it and in the apps that we're designing, but we're also relying on all the app developers out there to use that same touch language. And actually, it is really good for you to use that language, because every user, every person who will use your app will already know what the language is, because they have to go through Start, for instance, to even get to your app. So they will know those gestures and they will know those behaviors. Now, we created a simple 4-page document that explains the touch language, so the things that I just talked about. It talks about the behaviors, it talks about the touch interactions that there are. It also talks about the postures and what that means, and the touch target size. And you can find that document here, or this is a shortcut to the link. And I'll talk a little bit about mouse. So what about other input methods? Like, Windows is not only for touch. It actually still works really well with mouse. And what we did is we looked at the user interface, and we did two things. Either we made it so that it works both for mouse and for touch in a good way, mouse and trackpad, or we adapted the controls. So we made the visuals as similar as possible, and sometimes we use different methods to interact with the content, and I'll show you what that means. From a developer point of view, what we're saying is, you code for touch, you get mouse for free. It will work. We created it so that it works. And we made those controls change the behavior so that it works. But you can also create your own experiences. So you have the possibility to create specific experiences per input method, because you have access to that information. So I'll give you an example. If I'm in a start menu, I can scroll the menu, I can pan through the menu using touch. And in the bottom of the screen, you will see that, that just falls off the screen here. There's a thin line, which you can see up there, that is the scroll indicator that shows where you are in the list. But now if I start moving my mouse, bottom of the screen is not there. What you can see is that if I start moving my mouse at the bottom of the screen, a scroll bar appears. The scroll bar, as you are used to in Windows 7, for instance, but the design is updated to the Metro-style design, so it's a simplified design. And I can use this scroll bar to scroll through the list, but I also still have that other functionality. So, for instance, I can scroll line by line, or I can paginate through the list. So depending on which input method you use, if I use the mouse or the trackpad, I'll get my scroll bar. If I use my fingers on the screen, I will get the scroll indicator that is not interactive. Same thing for selection. Like, as I showed, I can select like this, but if I want to select with mouse, I can move my cursor over an item and I can right-click to select something, and I can also use that to multi-select. So in this case, we have the same visuals and the same behavior, but the way that you interact with the input methods are different. So that's just an example of how we adapted Windows to work both for touch and for mouse. So now it's up to you and all the app developers who are out there to build great touch apps using that touch language. And like I said, it is in the benefit of your users to do that, because it will be easy for them to use the app. It will be more intuitive and more enjoyable for them because they already know that touch language. And if you use the controls, the Windows 8 controls, that's the easiest way to implement that touch language. Now, here's some other talks about Windows 8 Touch if you want to know more. In the next session, my colleague Jan Christian Markiewicz is going to talk about the top traits of great Metro-style apps. And I'm going to talk later in the day about the self-revealing gestures, as I said. But you can also get more more technical information about how to develop for touch from the talks that were held at the Build conference that are available online. Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions. Are there any questions? That's too early in the morning for that, I guess. So is it possible to multi-select? You mean with touch? Okay, so the question is it possible to multi-select? Multi-select is just enabled because I can... Is that what you mean? I can multi-select. Like, oh, do you mean marquee select? Right. Yeah, so the question is, can you do continuous select using what we call marquee select? So I drag my finger and it kind of draws this rectangle to select. That is not possible here. So it's easy to select multiple things. If you want to do select all, then we recommend using a command in the app bar for that. But we don't have the drag in. The reason for that is because we wanted to use that gesture for something else, and I'll show that to you. So instead of using that for selection, we wanted to enable you to rearrange items in your collection. So I can select like this by dragging down, but now if I drag further down through what we call a speed bump, so I'm dragging slowly further, and if I drag far enough, the item will actually loosen from the grid. So now it's loose from the grid, and now I can start rearranging it. So instead of using that drag motion to multi-select, we want to make that for easily rearranging items on the grid. So that was just a decision we made. We thought that was a more important action than using that multi-select. Plus, as you could see in the movie, it's actually pretty easy to multi-select. So it would be nice to have that, but there's already other ways of doing that. Excuse me. Yeah, that's a good question too. The question is, why not use multiple fingers to do that? Well, and my answer is, at some point, you kind of run out of gestures. Because if I use my two fingers on the screen here, I'm actually zooming. So how do I tell the system that I'm not zooming, but that now I want to rearrange? Then there's another way of doing it, where I can first put my finger on the screen, and I can drag. But in this case, we actually chose that if I'm holding this item to rearrange, I can use my other hand to scroll quickly through the list so I can move this item somewhere else in the list if I want to. So again, we enabled those multi-touch gestures for something else, because that at this point was not the most important thing that we wanted to enable. Any other questions? Yeah. Sorry. You want to see the URL? Yeah, I'll share that. There we go. Sorry, what was your question? So the question is the touch language the same for Windows Phone as Windows 8? It's the same as much as possible. But what's interesting is that the different form factors sometimes require different things. And I'll give an example with zooming. So as I talked to you about the postures that we saw with the tablet, And the main one being that I have my whole hand free, right? So I can interact with this. So it's really easy to use my two fingers to zoom. It doesn't require any special effort. Now, if I have my phone, the most common posture is that I'm holding it with one hand and I'm using my other hand for something else and I'm interacting with my thumb. Now, suddenly, it's really hard to zoom. If I want to zoom with two fingers, I can either try it like this, which is really hard to do, or I have to use my other hand and I have to zoom like this, which happens if you use a map or photos, but most of the time you want to be able to interact like this. So on phone, they have something that's similar to semantic zoom. If you go into your contacts list, you can tap on a letter and you will get an overview of the alphabet and you can quickly jump to a letter. But it's a tapping action instead of a zooming action. And that makes sense because it's a different way of using this than using Windows. So that's one place where the interaction is slightly different. Kind of the functionality, the idea is the same, but the interaction is slightly different. But in most other places, the interactions are the same. So we try to align that as much as possible. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good question. So the question is, what happens if a company makes a tablet with a 5-inch screen? What does that mean for the touch language, right? Like, what do you then do? Do you use phone or not? And that's something that's going to be interesting for us to figure out. Like, how small do we recommend that Windows tablets can go? And I don't know exactly where we are with that. I know there's a lot of experimentation going on there, like what works and what doesn't work, because it's not only the touch language that changes, but for instance, also your start menu, like how many tiles still fit on there, how big are your pixels, right? What is your resolution? So there's a lot of aspects there. And at what point should you move to the Windows Phone system? So I think it's a good question. I cannot give you the recommendations right now. I think we do not have them yet, but we are working on those, where we're saying, like, well, if you're smaller than 7-inch or something, maybe it should be the phone system instead of the Windows system. But it's a really good point. I think the interactions change when your form factors changes. Yeah. We have time for one more question, if there's one more. Yeah, okay, so last question. Sorry, can you say it again with the thumb keyword? Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, did you create designs for other controls that work like the thumb keyboard, where they're optimized for thumbs? And my answer is no, not specifically. So we don't have thumb versions of the controls. But one of the things, as you saw in the slides, is, for instance, for the app bar, what we're recommending is that you put your commands, your most important commands, on the outside, because that's where they're easy to reach for thumbs. So it's more in the form of recommendations, like these are the areas that are easy to reach with thumbs and it's always easy to reach with your finger, than that we are adapting the controls. Because with the thumb keyboard, you actually specifically have to invoke that thumb keyboard. So there's a menu that you see there where I can go to the thumb keyboard and now I can start typing in it. But it's not something that happens automatically because we can't detect what your posture is at this point. So then you would have to adapt the slate all the time to what your posture is. It might be nice if at some point we have sensors where we can actually detect how you're holding it, but I guess we're not there yet right now. Okay, so that was my time is up. Thank you very much for being here. Great questions. I'm happy to talk to you afterwards if you want to. So, thanks.